Hi, it's David Remnick, and I've got a quick but important note before we start. Up till now, the podcast of the New Yorker Radio Hour has been the same hour-long program that we put on the radio. We're changing that. We're going to give you two episodes, same contents, but we've rearranged it for the best podcast listening experience, because we know an hour can be a lot to tackle sometimes. So we'll post the second part of the show in a couple of days. If you want to hear exactly the hour that we broadcast on the radio, no problem. You can always do that at newyorkerradio.org. You can play it right off the homepage. And listen, this is important. Please let me know what you think of the new format. Email us at newyorkerradio@wnyc.org. And here's the episode.
They're trying to answer questions about upward mobility in America.
He's the military strategist. It was profiled brilliantly by somebody.
So I think if you could, find a subculture of people.
With a kind of form of life on this planet that we haven't really seen before.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and on today's Summer Festival show, we're talking to two of the top performers in popular music. In 2012, staff writer Aria Levy sat down with one of the most acclaimed American songwriters of recent years, Lucinda Williams. Williams has released 13 albums and wrote songs for everyone, from Mary Chapin Carpenter to Patti Loveless to Tom Petty. She's a winner of 3 Grammy Awards, and last year, she released the record Ghosts of Highway 20. Here's Lucinda Williams with Aria Levy.
A lot of your music strikes me as really spiritual, and you've got God on your belt buckle, and you told me...
Get right with God.
Get right with God. Yeah. Right on your belt buckle, just like your song.
Yeah.
And you were telling me that you had your house in Nashville, you had this wall of...
Crosses. Different crosses, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like art, Day of the Dead kind of stuff, and Santeria.
And both your grandfathers were ministers.
Methodist ministers, yeah.
So tell us a little bit, if you would, about the role that religion and God have played in your life and in your music. And I'm particularly interested in concepts of sin and redemption, which I think come up in your music a lot.
My dad's father, for instance, was a Methodist minister. But, you know, he was what I describe as a Christian in the true sense of the word. You know, he was... for women's rights. He was a CO in World War I and was involved in the Southern Tenant Union's farmer struggle and all of that, you know. And then my dad, by the time I was born and growing up and everything, my dad described himself as agnostic. So.
What about you? Do you consider yourself agnostic?
No. but I don't believe in original sin. So I'm not a Christian, you know, I guess. Except I feel like I live my life more like a Christian than a lot of Christians.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's all, everybody knows what I'm talking about. You know, but I just love the folklore and the mythology and the symbolism of it all, you know.
One of the things I really envy about religious people is that they can walk through life with a sense of destiny. And it seems to me that a lot of artists have that same blessing, you know? Like, at what point in your life did you know or did you feel that music was your calling?
Well, at least probably from the time I was about 12 years old, which is when I started taking guitar lessons. And it was the same year I first heard Bob Dylan. Highway 61 Revisited in 1965.
Did it start for you with sound or words, or was it indistinguishable?
It started before that. I mean, there was always a piano around the house because my mother played, you know. Music books would be laying around and music being played in the house. My dad was listening to everyone from Hank Williams to John Coltrane, Chet Baker, Lightning Hopkins, you know.
And so when did you start writing? When did you start doing your own songs?
Well, I mean, I was, you know, fooling around with it and everything, but from the age of probably about 13 or 14, you know.
And your father was this great poet, Miller Williams. Was he a big influence on you in terms of writing?
Yeah, Yeah.
He encouraged you?
Yeah, he encouraged me. And I mean, you know, there were other writers, poets, and novelists in the house, you know, a lot. And see, he taught at different universities. So I grew up in that academic environment, mm-hmm. you know, and it's very, you know, stimulating and just, you know, he'd have people over at the house and it would just be people like, you know, John Cleland Holmes and John Chardy and James Dickey. And that was the environment.
And he took you to meet Flannery O'Connor when you were a little girl?
Yeah, when I was about 4 years old. He was, yeah, we were living in Macon, Georgia at the time. And she invited him to the house. And so he took me to her house where she lived. And she had this real strict writing schedule. And we couldn't come in the house yet until she finished. You know, she would get up early and write from 8 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon or whatever it was. Uh-huh. And the shades were open when we first got there, and then we saw the shades kind of go down, you know, because it wasn't time yet to let the guests come in. But Flannery O'Connor was a huge inspiration and influence. You know, when I was about 16, I guess, I just devoured everything she wrote.
Do you remember, you know, what about it? What about her writing so inspiring to you?
I connected with it because of the darkness, the Southern Gothic weirdness and dark thing that I saw in my own life. And, you know, it was so descriptive and, you know, and humorous at the same time. Almost like a Shakespearean kind of Southern thing.
Tell us a little bit about when you first started playing music, singing as a job, you know, in New Orleans when you were real young and you were playing in bars. Was that a fun time in your life? Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, you're talking about the first little gig I got in New Orleans. Yeah, I was in between. Well, my dad always wanted me to, you know, get a degree in something so I could have something to fall back on. And we were encouraged to, you know, have a career, whatever it was. So I got into the University of Arkansas where he was teaching in 1971. And I was going down to the quarter because we had lived there for a while when I was growing up. I went to high school there and everything. So I had some friends there and all. So I was going down to the French Quarter and hanging out. And there was this little folk club called Andy's on Bourbon Street, right in the middle of all the strip joints. It's really odd. And anyway, I got offered a little gig playing there, like, you know, 3 nights a week for tips, which was a huge deal for me. This was in 1972 or something, you know. So I called my dad and I said, you know, instead of coming back to school in the fall, I want to stay down here and do this. And he said, okay. That was probably the biggest turning point in my entire, what became, you know, my career.
Because he gave you permission to be an artist,
permission.
Essentially.
I needed to have his permission. You know. And we were talking about that, like, it's important for, you know, kids to have at least one or someone they don't want to disappoint. Doesn't have to be one of your parents, but somebody, you know, that you don't want to disappoint them.
Uh-huh.
You know, so that was my dad for me, so, you know.
And then another big turning point after that is when you get your first development deal. And you must have thought... And this is when you moved to LA, and you must have thought, my ship is in, I made it.
I'm there, I've made it, I was on cloud 9.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was a guy at RCA at the time, and he really liked me and, you know, saw something there. So they used to do this back then. They called it a development deal, and this was in 1985, I guess. And they give you enough money to live on for 6 months or something. And so I had enough, for the first time, I didn't have to work a day job, and all I had to do was, you know, write some songs, and then they send you in the studio to do a demo tape, and hopefully they sign you after that.
And there were some great songs on that demo tape, weren't there?
The same ones that ended up on the Rough Trade album.
Uh-huh.
Passionate Kisses and Crescent City and all.
And Passionate Kisses was the first song that you won a Grammy for.
Yeah, that was Mary Chapin Carpenter.
Years later, not until 1994. But the Grammy, so she recorded it, you win for Best Country.
I won for Country Song of the Year. Yeah, that was kind of a funny thing. It was really because Mary Chapin Carpenter was being marketed in the country arena. She picked that song up and recorded it. And at the time, her label or whoever was in charge, you know, said, no, we don't want that to be the single. It's not country enough. Mm-hmm. And she stood her ground, and they put it out as a single, and then it won a Grammy for Country Song of the Year.
And so it wins a Grammy for Country Song of the Year, but it was on that first demo of yours that you did for this development deal, which they didn't pick up.
Right.
That's going to be gratifying.
I got passed on by everybody. Yeah, it's gratifying later on.
To win a Grammy for a song they didn't pick up?
Yeah.
I mean, you could just...
Well, I couldn't get signed for anything. Uh-huh. I mean, because at the time, back in the mid-'80s, there was no Americana. There was no alternative country. There was no, you know, all of this. So they didn't know. I literally fell in the cracks, according to them, between country and rock.
But in terms of music... You know, people always give you a lot of credit for having a lot of integrity and
staying true
to your sound, which I can certainly understand. But you think sometimes that that's been about fear.
It was a lot of it was just, you know, when I was first starting out, I was, you know, terrified of being overproduced and all of this, you know, because I had seen other folk blues heroes kind of mine or who had made these horrible horrendous albums. Like the 70s, you know, the disco thing came along and all of a sudden, you know.
So I think of you as one of the great erotic poets of our time. And and it seems like you're really comfortable and really uninhibited as well as really brilliant writing and singing about sex. Do you feel like...
Yes. I like to... The truth is I like to push people's buttons a little bit. I think it's from growing up as, you know, with my dad, a poet, and all the poets and everything. I mean, they didn't censor themselves, and that was one of the things my dad taught me about writing. Don't censor yourself, you know. So that's the way I approach songwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And although I like to do it in a sort of elegant, somewhat, you know, it's not like a punk thing. That's a whole different thing, you know, so... I don't want to, like, cram it down people's throats.
Yeah, it's you're trying to make people feel something. You're not trying to assault them.
Yeah.
But it just made me... It is sort of punk. I was just thinking about... Wasn't there a thing where a woman sort of... you were playing Essence, and there was a woman at a show who sort of spontaneously...
Oh, my God.
...invested in sexual
fervor? This was at the House of Blues in New Orleans. And it was after Hurricane Katrina. So there was this really odd... energy in the, you know, you could feel it in the whole city, really, this kind of sort of kind of subliminal anger or something, you know. Anyway, so I was there with the band, we played Essence, and the place was packed, and I didn't see it, I didn't witness it, you know, but apparently there was a woman who was there who was masturbating, and they called the cops, and apparently she was kicking the policeman because she wasn't finished yet or something. Which I could totally understand, you know. So I don't know if she was on ecstasy. I don't know what the hell. But
it's a very sexy song.
I felt this kind of little pride about that, you know, like, you know.
Yeah.
Damn, I mean, that's pretty gutsy. Not ballsy. I hate saying that about when it's a woman. I hate that.
Has anything changed about the way you write songs?
I feel like I'm more... confident now. I feel like I'm actually writing more. I used to just barely have enough songs for one album. And because I wasn't used to that, you know, the cycle of, you know, writing, recording, touring.
Yeah.
Writing, recording, touring, you know.
Yeah.
And now I found myself just really a lot more productive as a songwriter, you know.
Has anything changed about performing? What have you learned about performing? How have you evolved as a performer?
I've gotten better at, I think my stage presence has improved. And because I realized I was never going to be, you know, a performer and all of this, you know. But in the beginning, I mean, I was just so painfully shy. And I would just kind of look down like this and, you know. And I still get nervous, you know. But it helps to have a great band behind you, you know, and have that connection and feel secure. And when I first started out, I really didn't think of myself in terms of being a great singer. I mean, so that's one reason I decided to learn how to write good songs, because I didn't want to be compared. Because at the time, all I had, the singers I had to look, the female singers were Joan Baez, who had this incredibly beautiful high voice, Judy Collins, and then later Linda Ronstadt and, you know, Joni Mitchell. And I wasn't able to do that vocally. So
was it Emmy Lou Harris or somebody?
Emmy Lou Harris was another one.
But who said to you?
Oh, yeah. She said one time, you know, your limitations are your strength. Your limitations become your strength and all.
Well, speaking of great songwriting, great vocals, let's have a big round for Lucinda the Person.
This is called World Without Tears. If we live in a world without tears, how would bruises find face to lie upon? How would scars find skin to etch themselves into? How would broken find the bone? If we live in a world without tears, how would heartbeats know when to stop? How would blood know which body to flow outside of? How would bullets find the gun? And if we live in a world without tears, how would misery know which back door to walk through? How would trouble know which mind to live inside of? How would sorrow find a home? And if we live in a world without tears, how would bruises find a face to lie upon? How would scars find skin to etch themselves into? How would broken find the bone? How would bullets find the guns? How would sorrow find a home? Thank you.
Aria Levy talking with singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. Next week, I'll talk with Ezekiel Emanuel, a doctor and healthcare policy expert. Emanuel advised President Obama on the Affordable Care Act, and now he's been trying to influence the Republican Party as they set about trying to dismantle it. That's next week. Until then, you can find us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio. I'm David Remnick. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with special help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Alexis Goldberg, Hillary Leichter, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.